Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So we are back here again in the chair and talking about another week that's gone by. And a few things have happened this week. Which we're not talking about, but a few things have happened in the old Bettinelli homestead that we'd like to kind of talk about. First, I want to mention, discuss. We have a new evening routine. After years and years of our evening basically went dinner, kids running from the table, you and I cleaning up, hounding them to get their pajamas on, hounding them to take their medicine and brush their teeth, sitting down to prayers, reading a book, sending them to bed. We realized this no longer worked for us.
Right.
Partly because it was so much work for us.
Right. Because we had never really established the idea that everybody stays at the table until we're all done, because we liked to linger and talk and the kids would wolf down their food and be done and then run away to play.
Yes, they'd get bored.
But now they're old enough not to really get bored, and they can participate in dinnertime conversation as well as in the food. And they're all old enough to help out. So we decided to do some tweaking. We were getting frustrated. And I thought, what if, we did things in a different order?
So for a little while, we started getting the older girls, to start doing the dishes after dinner.
Right.
So they would empty the dishwasher if there were clean dishes that had just been done in it. We usually run the dishwasher
before
start cooking dinner, because, lunch dishes and that sort of stuff. So empty the dishwasher and then load it best they can. And then I usually end up doing the pots and pans. We'll get there on the pots and pans. But the problem is we'd have to, halfway through the meal, say Sophie would be done and she'd be off in the living room or in their bedroom. And, we'd have to gather them back together. And so the new routine is when they get at the table, they have to stay at the table or at worst, they have to stay in the kitchen or dining room. If they have to, you go to the bathroom, they can go to the bathroom, but they have to come back. And we're still working on this part of it, getting them to remember that they're not supposed to fade away into the living room or into their bedrooms or whatever.
Right. But generally they're remembering, and when they're reminded of I feel like there's a difference when you're reminding a child of a rule that they know and have internalized, they just have forgotten, versus trying to get them to do something that you want them to do that they don't want to do. Like reminding them of a rule, it seems to me like there's less fuss and mess.
Yes. There, at least for our kids, there's more acceptance of it. They may not like it. They may try to slither out of it, but they don't dispute it.
But they don't dispute that it is a rule and that they know the rule and they will follow the rule when they're called on the carpet.
And we recognize, so we had to lay it out. This is going to be the new regime. We're going to start enforcing it. And we know that it's going to take a while for them to remember and to break old habits.
Right. You're not going to remember this all the time. And we're not going to be punitive if you forget. Just we'll remind you.
But one of the toughest things is the whole slithering out thing. Like they all have this tendency at one time or another to kind of everyone's working to, especially, and this is a problem when you have a big family. It's easy to kind of sneak out on the edge, go sneak out into another room.
Yeah.
And honestly, I did the same thing when I was younger. So, when I was their age and younger. So it happens. You gotta be vigilant. And they police each other to some degree.
That can be dangerous.
I was going to say, yeah, sometimes a little too much. So So this is that part of it. Stay to the end of dinner, and when we say dinner is done, then everyone has to help clean up. And part of it is there aren't set jobs, except for the two older girls doing the dishes for the other three. So we have to be constantly finding them something to do before they run off.
What we're trying to work on is the habit of saying, what can I do next? As opposed to, oh, I finished the last job you gave me so I can, you know, go do what I want to do.
Yeah. Go get containers for the leftovers. Carry these dishes to the sink. Go put these in the fridge. You know, that sort of stuff.
Some of them are a little bit better at looking for the next thing to do, and some of them are a little bit more prone to wanting to.
And it changes day to day,
yeah,
depending on their mood and their what have you. So that part is okay. And then the next part, we're still working out the bugs, because it's this transition from cleaning. Because what happens is certain jobs finish up earlier than other jobs.
Right. And so then finding something to do for the kids who have finished the jobs that you've assigned them. And when you're kind of at your wit's end for finding something else for them to do, which I don't always have a default, like, okay, well, then go do this if you're done.
Right.
So I'm sometimes defaulting to, well, just go sit down in the living room. But that doesn't seem fair to the kid who's still doing the chore that you asked them to do. Sometimes I'm just saying, fine, go get your pajamas on.
Right.
I mean, in general, the idea of having them work until we're all done, if it works out perfectly, and then we sit down and pray, and then they can go get their pajamas on, means that I don't have a particular preference as to how quickly or slowly they dawdle in getting their pajamas on and brushing their teeth and getting themselves to bed.
Right. The big problem was they were holding up prayers for the whole family. So that, and by waiting to get their pajamas on and brush their teeth and take their medicine and all that other stuff was holding up prayers.
Because they would go into their room to get their pajamas on and they would find a book that they wanted to read. Yeah. Or they would find the Legos that they had left that they just want to, it got knocked over and I just want to pick it up and I put it together again. And by the time they're done putting it together, they're playing a game with the Legos.
Right.
And or whatever.
Yes. So this way, we're not holding everybody up. And frankly, part of it is me. Like, I have several evenings where I have to, you know, go and record a podcast or something after prayers are done and that sort of stuff. And suddenly it's 8:00. I need to go to the office and start preparing. We haven't even said prayers yet, and I get anxious. And so, so this way we move it earlier.
Right. By reordering it, you can go do your thing while right. they're getting their pajamas on and brushing their teeth and all that stuff. You don't need to hang out and wait for them to.
I get less anxious and frustrated while I'm sitting in the living room. I'm usually reading or something, but still, like, frustrated and sitting and waiting for them. Like, what's taking so long? So this way, this all happens afterward when I don't have to be the one right. sitting in there waiting.
And if they wait until lights out time to do it, and then that's their problem.
And you're not like having to tuck them in individually either.
Right.
Like,
they're all old enough to kind of get themselves to bed. I mean, a couple of them sort of like having me pull up the blankets and tuck them in and do the sort of formal tuck in, but most of them are beyond that.
Right.
They're more likely to just like come find me wherever I am and, you know, give me a kiss and say goodnight and then get themselves to bed.
I think this is that thing about the transition from in phases. When they're little, there's a particular way that you have to do things. But as they grow older, you have to be flexible. I mean, parenthood is really about flexibility, not rigidity.
Right.
You have to be flexible and recognize, okay, the old way is no longer fits.
Right. We no longer have small children who need help brushing their teeth or putting on pajamas. They no longer need hand-holding and tucking into bed. A couple of them like me to read a bedtime story still, but most of them just disappear to their rooms to read their own books.
Or chitter chatter
or play, which I discourage.
Talking about you, Bella and Sophie.
I prefer them to go to their rooms and read as opposed to go to their rooms and play. It's supposed to be kind of a quiet winding down time. So sort of you can read in your bed for a while. You know, we don't demand lights out right away because I don't want to like to have to go to my room, turn off the light, and go to bed without any sort of transition. I like to read in bed, so I let them have that same pleasure. And generally, they're pretty good about that.
They're turning into little mini-yous.
Well, yeah.
They're all going to be night owls. Except for Sophie, she's kind of in between. She stays up late, but she gets up early.
Right.
So I'm curious to see how that changes as she goes into her teens.
Yeah, she's still in the tweens, really.
Yeah, that should be interesting. So it's, well, I mean, if it radically changes, we'll talk about it again. But
so far so good.
I think for the moment, this is the way things should go. As time passes and they change, they get older. I mean, we aren't yet at the point where I think where some folks with older kids, where the kids stay up with them and watch TV with them. That would be weird.
Like, yeah.
I watch a lot of different things. I'm not quite ready to watch. Like, I don't think Bella wants to watch all the same stuff I watch. We only get the one TV. Yeah, I'm not sure how that will work.
Right. I don't know.
There's a future transition coming where they're going to want to stay up like we do, have a nightlife, in a sense.
Right. Right now, they're kind of content to just, they go to their bedrooms, they read their books, or they chit-chat with each other for a while, and then they go to bed.
Right.
And, but they're basically, essentially, after dinner and bedtime prayers, they're kind of, like, done being, like, in the family area, socializing.
I think a big part is that they don't generally watch TV. They watch a couple things. They watch Star Wars, you know, on Sundays or when The Mandalorian is on. But that's about it. They don't watch TV. So that's, what else is there to do out there?
Right.
I can imagine at some point Bella wanting to sit out in the living room and read.
Occasionally she does. Occasionally she sort of wants to be alone, and so she'll sit in the living room instead of in her bedroom.
Right.
If I'm in the living room, though, I kind of chase her out because I...
You need your alone time.
I want to be quiet and alone.
Yeah.
And not have her chattering at me.
Yeah, she has a tendency to want to talk. She's not, yeah. She's not, I mean, an introvert like
I,
you.
I
she's
talk,
an extrovert.
I don't know about that.
I don't know about that. Out of wishes. Sorry. That's the Saturday Night Live.
I do talk to her. I don't refuse to have a conversation with her, but I sort of limit the conversation to, okay, I'm done having a conversation. Now you can go.
And yes, she is that direct. You do not mince words when you want to.
I've discovered that, especially with Isabella, mincing words doesn't really communicate very well with her. She's kind of like my sister. She appreciates directness, and she doesn't want hints or
ambiguity.
Suggestions or ambiguity. But she's very happy. I mean, she's not offended if I say, okay, I'm done talking to you now. You can go to bed. She'll say, oh, okay, good night. And she's fine. Like, she's not offended.
That doesn't work with me. That offends me.
Well.
But you don't care that way. So, well, like I said, we'll talk about this further, I'm sure, as things develop and as we move along. But so far, so good. So the other big thing this week was we celebrated the Feast of Epiphany on Wednesday. Yes, Wednesday, the 6th, January 6th, which is technically the 12th night. You know, the 12th day of Christmas, that's Epiphany, liturgically celebrated on the Sunday before. But
in this country, there are places where it's still celebrated on
Wednesday,
on the 6th, whatever the day is.
So we, as I mentioned, we do Epiphany gifts. That's where we do a lot of the gift giving. The non-Santa gift giving happens that day, and including lots of family gifts. And so there was a bunch of gifts from grandma and granddad came from Texas, which we were talking about. It's funny because they might send stuff to us, or they'll accident. What they like to do is put the kids' names on their boxes, like their presents. So, you know, a box will come from Amazon that says Isabella, and one, you know, will come for Anthony. But they'll sometimes send them. We're getting boxes of our own. You and I, Melly and I, are getting our own boxes with our names on them from things that we've had to order for the house or whatever, or for the kids.
Or presents that we've ordered to give to the kids.
Right. So a box comes, and I'm like, this isn't in my list of things my tracking list. So is this for me? Is this a present from my in-laws? Is this something for one of the kids that get mislabeled? I don't know. I guess I have to open it. So you had one or two gifts that you opened early, right?
There was one thing that I opened early because I wasn't sure. I saw what it was, sort of, and realized it had a gift slip on it. But what I didn't realize is that Amazon had mixed up my mom's gifts. Evidently, she ordered Lucy's birthday gift and my Epiphany gifts at the same time. And so the Amazon packer put Lucy's birthday gifts in with my Epiphany gifts. Like, there were two different boxes that had one gift for me and one gift for Lucy
in the two different boxes.
Yeah,
they split the two gifts between the two boxes.
Well, the four gifts
intermingled.
Yeah. It was intermingled. It was confusing.
Yes.
So Lucy didn't get her birthday gifts from Grandma and Granddad until Epiphany.
And so she got the big hit. I think this was the big hit. The baby Grogu doll, the baby Yoda.
That was her birthday present, though.
Okay, from us?
From us.
Oh, okay.
That was definitely the big hit.
All right,
of the week.
Yeah, but that has been the big hit. That little guy has traveled everywhere with her and with the others too, which she's fine with. The others.
Yeah, they keep kidnapping him and taking him places.
Yeah. But see, what else was there? Lots of Star Wars shirts.
I think everybody got probably two Star Wars T-shirts, one from us and one from my parents.
Yes.
And
you got two of the same one, but different colors, black or blue.
Yeah, two Mandalorian T-shirts. Everybody got a book. Everybody got a small toy.
Yes. Several Lego sets.
There were several Lego sets. There were some more Star Wars figures. Anthony got the troop transport.
Yes.
Imperial troop transport.
When I was a kid, Kenner made the Star Wars action figures, and Kenner eventually became part of Hasbro. And so Hasbro has come out with they call it the Vintage Collection, and they're basically recreations of the same style as of the figures back when I was a kid, but for the new properties. So this is the troop transport from The Mandalorian, you know, which obviously wasn't there at the time. And so from Rise of Skywalker and all that sort of stuff. So we got a lot of those this year. This was when we were trying to figure out Star Wars stuff to buy them. We've run out of Star Wars Lego sets. I think we mentioned that before.
Yeah.
Star Wars Lego sets that we can afford for them. They're all the Star Wars Lego sets that are in the affordable price range have been purchased and are owned. And now there's just the stuff that's too expensive. But this stuff is an untapped resource.
They already own quite a few action figures, but
different sizes.
But different sizes.
Yeah. So there's the Black Series, which is the one that your mom got for Sophie, was the Sabine, which she loved. That was an awesome gift. But then there's this other, the older style action figures. And so Anthony, we were kind of concerned because he really wanted a Star Wars Lego set. We didn't have one to give him. So I thought this might be acceptable. And I think it was.
I think
he was pretty happy with it.
Everybody wanted to play with it, and they were putting all sorts of figures in the troop transport.
Yes.
Whether it's canonical or not, our kids don't really play in the movie that those people wouldn't have been riding in the troop transport. Right. So we can't use it for them. No, they're pretty much like the rebels hijacked it. And
they come up with all kinds of
fun scenarios.
Yes. Bella got one of her presents came today or yesterday. Was late. It was a Hera from Rebels, and it's a great shirt. Bella loves that character, and she's such a great character. She's she's a warrior, but she's also like the mom of the crew, and yeah.
So she's very maternal and very warm, and she kind of refers to the younger members of the crew as the kids.
Right.
At times, there's a very much a. We are a family, and Hera is very much the mother of the family. And yet, yeah, she's a crack pilot, like really, really, really good pilot. And in the Star Wars universe, that's everything.
Yes.
And she's fierce. And I love that this T-shirt is great. It shows her in an action pose as opposed to like the pretty, like... Look at
Star Wars princess.
Star Wars princess pose.
Yeah.
She's got a blaster. It's pointing down. She's charging like in mid run, and there's kind of a snarl on her face. Like she looks like she's fiercely going into Mama Bear attack mode to protect one of her crew members who's under attack.
Yes,
and that's kind of perfect for Isabella. She's very warm and maternal in many ways, like taking care of the younger kids, but she's also fierce and she loves warplanes and like armaments and stuff. And so like for her, Hera is like sort of the perfect Star Wars character.
Yeah. Yes. It is pretty awesome. And so it's a great shirt. What else was there? I think just the other stuff. I got you a few things, got you a bird feeder and the bedside organizer.
Yes. I like it.
So yeah, it was, and then I got a gift certificate. So I got a few things for myself and that's about, it was quiet.
It was good. I made a king cake. It kind of,
king bagel.
It looked like a big bagel.
It looked like a giant bagel. It was awesome.
And I tried to make it filled with like a cream cheese filling and it didn't quite bake all the way through in the middle. So it was kind of doughy with cream cheese. It still tasted really good, but I've got to work on my filled baked goods game.
Yeah, you've had a couple of misfires on those. There's a trick to it that maybe not getting on that.
Yeah, something. I don't know.
All right. Well, I mean, like you said, it was tasty, though. It was good.
It was tasty. It was fun. Yeah. It was good.
So so that was Epiphany. And then yesterday, as we record, it was a cold but pretty day. Cold but sunny. Blue skies. I had a Zoom meeting in the morning, a board meeting for Mass Citizens for Life. I'm on the board there, and that ended not too late. I was able to, and that just before you guys were heading out I wasn't sure I'd be able to go, so I was, and so we went out for a hike in the local state park not too far from us. We are so lucky because not only do we have the town forest in Holbrook, and there's a town forest in Braintree that we could go to. And then there's the Brockton Fields Park, but there's the Ames Knoll State Park. And then there's the, if we're going to go even a little further, Wampatuck. I mean, there's a lot of places we can go.
Yeah.
This is a really great place.
And all the trails in, Weymouth.
Weymouth. Yes. Oh yeah. Yes. The trails that we've talked about.
Yeah. It's
so we decided to go to the close one, Ames Knoll, which has the big pond. And
the pond was mostly frozen over
not safe to walk.
Partly frozen over.
Yeah, there was ice all the way across. But put it that way.
Yeah,
it was ice all the way across.
But it was thin ice.
But it was you would have been on thin ice if you went out there. But it was so cool because the kids started throwing rocks at it.
And when the rocks hit a big field, like a big frozen body of water, it makes this really unexpected twanging kind of sound.
It's almost like if you hit a saw blade.
Yeah,
almost like thin metal.
Right. It's got a kind of a metallic.
If you were to walk up to like one of the wires, like a metal cable running down from like a phone telephone pole,
right,
and hit it with a stick or with a wrench or something, it would make that twanging noise. It's like that.
Right.
Yeah. And so they were throwing the rocks and they were trying to make the sound.
To see who could throw the rock the furthest. Yeah. The cool thing about throwing rocks onto a frozen body of water
is you can measure.
Can see if my rock went further than yours because your rock is still sitting there on top of the ice.
That's right. As we were coming out, there was a kid and his dad, and the kid was like breaking up chunks of ice and throwing it. And it was because it's ice, lower friction, it would go way further. And the thing to keep in mind with pond ice is it's not smooth. It's not like a hockey rink for people who aren't from the north. As it freezes, if it freezes slowly and not a deep freeze very quick, it freezes as the water is moving. And so it has bumps and it's rough surface. And so as the ice chunks sliding across, it's bumping and making that noise all the way across. And if it breaks up, it's even more. So it was really cool. It was making really cool sounds. So we did mask. We masked up as you do, and wore masks. If we encountered people, we'd lower the mask. I mean, we'd put raise the mask. But as we started, it was cold enough. We weren't warmed up enough. Actually, wearing the mask was more comfortable.
actually, a nice face warmer.
Yeah. In fact, I got out my neck gaiter and wore that instead. But as we got hiking, we warmed up. And so we would take the opportunity to take it to pull it down. But we got, what did I say, about a third of the way around the pond?
My watch said it was about two. We did about 2 mile hike.
Out and back was 2 miles.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. So it's a long hike around. This the part of it is because it has this. It jogs out to the left. It's got this dog leg on the pond that kind of juts out to the east.
We've never made it even close to actually circumnavigating the pond.
Yeah, it's a nice long walk, and there's a boardwalk that goes over the
bog.
It has a railing like almost like a deck where it has the wooden slats. And what was one of the kids grabbed a stick and was bonking it along the side of it and making a fun musical sound.
It was a day of finding found musical sounds.
Yes. But then you found the frozen ice crystals in the mud.
Oh, yeah. Really cool phenomenon. They're called ice needles. And I read about the explanation in Wikipedia and I sort of half understood it. But when water is flowing underground, but the air is colder than freezing, then the water tends to sort of extrude and form these long, thin, like needles. Sometimes they're straight, sometimes they can kind of curve a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they poke up like through the sand or the mud, like especially at the sides of trails, like it says, like in an embankment or a place where the ground is kind of terraced.
Right.
So like right on the edge of the trail where it kind of comes down, there are all these really cool structures, like ice structures.
Yeah, it says when the temperature of the soil is above 32 degrees and the surface temperature of the air is below 32 degrees, then the liquid water underground rises to the surface by capillary action and then freezes. And that creates that needle-like ice column. And so you get these really cool structures, and it's like basically, what was I saying? It's like mud turning to ice palaces.
Yeah, they look like little teeny miniature crystal palaces.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, you could come up with a little interesting poetic metaphor about, you know, mud becomes an ice palace or something like that, or something like along those lines. But it was really cool. We took a bunch of pictures of those, and looking at the different rock formations, there was a big rock that had rolled at some time in the ancient glacial past, and you could see where it broke off from the part below it and the stratification. So it was a lot of fun, and there's quite a few people out. Not tons of people, but I thought it was a lot of people for a midwinter day, with a cold midwinter day.
I think that there are probably quite a few people who, like us, were getting cabin fever and took the opportunity of a sunny day to get out and enjoy.
Well, that's actually one of the big motivations, right? Some of the children were bouncing off the walls.
Literally
bouncing off the walls and driving their siblings crazy.
So, not to mention their parents.
Yeah. So
there was an excess of energy. Let's just say that.
Yeah, these children need to get out and get out. Moving around, we decided that we need to be getting out on the trail much more than we do, like on that, not like through hiking on the Appalachian Trail, but just getting outside and hiking and walking.
This time of year, there's so many days when it's just too wet, too cold, too nasty, and
so that when the opportunity hits, you gotta go.
And I mean, let's face it, there's sort of the post Christmas like. Blahs.
the looking through, standing at the edge of January and looking at the great expanse of winter ahead into March or
I usually April. Find this is about the time of year when I'm like, you know what, winter hikes aren't that bad. Like in November and December, I'm like, it's cold, I want to hibernate, and by January, February, I'm like, okay, I'm done hibernating. Now we need to just get out of doors. I don't care how cold or whatever it is.
As I reached my 50s, I thought, this is the time of year when I want to fly south to the warm parts of the country. Although looking at pictures today from Texas and Florida, I don't know where those warm parts of the country are anymore.
Right. My family were all sharing pictures of snow in Texas today. They were all gleefully enjoying the fat white flakes falling from the sky.
Well, yeah, I want to go where it's warm. That's what I want to go. But in the absence of that, I do want to go out and get some hikes. And so one of the things I did was I bought a twig stove, which is a small collapsible metal contraption about 6 inches by 8 inches or so that you put together, and then you just you put sticks in it and you light them on fire and you can like boil water on it or cook a lunch on it. But
it packs down flat to like be just like a flat package.
Yeah.
And then you can put it together. Like, so it's really easy to carry on the trail and just burn whatever you find.
You can even put Sterno cans in it. So yeah, so I want to do more of the like hike out, take one or two of the kids with me, hike out into the woods, hang out, heat up some tea or hot chocolate or coffee or something. Probably not coffee because it's a little more work, but even if it was just like heat up some water and make a cup of tea or something and just hang out, out in the woods for a couple hours, that just to get outside. I think that's the thing when the weather will do. I've been watching this YouTube channel by from this guy in England. His name is, it's called Simon, A Bloke in the Woods, I think it's called. And he lives near Norfolk in England, and he's a carpenter by trade, so he's self-employed, but he loves to be in the woods, and he has these great videos of him getting out and like cooking in the woods, which is one of the reasons I was watching, because I like to look at outdoor cooking videos. And so he did this. He went out and made himself an omelet in the woods. He had a flat cast iron skillet, a flat oval-shaped pan. Without sides, so he could carry it in his pack. And he brought eggs and some mushrooms and some blood sausage and made himself an omelet. Yeah. I'm like, okay, on a twig stove. So I'm like, I totally want to do this. Maybe not make a blood sausage omelet, but.
Blood sausage is going to be good.
Oh, yeah. But that's something to attain at some point.
Well, actually, I haven't had good blood sausage in this country. I've only had it in England and Ireland. The one time I tried to buy the one brand I've been able to find around here, it was not good. Yeah. I did not like the seasonings.
What was that? Amrine's was the restaurant, the Irish restaurant in Boston that was famous for having the Irish full breakfast.
That sounds good.
Yeah. I don't know if they're still around. So that was our hike. So one other thing I wanted to talk about is, we got some sad news that, someone we knew from way back online, had passed away. So back in, what was it, about 2000, 2001, it was when I started my blog at BetNet, and it was one of the first Catholic blogs. And I think the only Catholic blog that later on, people were trying to figure out. The one that was the oldest was by this Canadian Catholic woman named Kathy Scheidel. And I forget what the original blog was or what her blog title was.
It was something about being little and ferocious. I don't know.
No,
that was...
No. It was the one about the return or the revert or something reversion. I forget what it was. I should have looked it up. But her later blog that she created was called 5 Feet of Fury.
That's what it was. Small. Yeah. I knew it had to do with height and shortness and
fierceness,
right?
Yes. So 5 Feet of Fury was her later blog. But she had one about the revert or something along those lines. But hers was the first Catholic blog that, as far as anyone could figure out. And so we all kind of looked up to her. Well, Kathy just passed away from cancer, and her partner shared her obituary that she wrote for herself online. And I want to read it because it is just so Kathy and it's so great. And it's such a great tribute to her. So let me read it and you can get a sense of who Kathy was and why we all loved Kathy so much. It says, following a tedious rendezvous with ovarian cancer, Kathy Scheidel has died, wishing she'd spent more time at the office. Her tombstone reads, "Get off my lawn." She's relieved she won't have to update her LinkedIn profile, shave her legs, or hear Creep by Radiohead ever again. Some may even be jealous that she's getting out of enduring a Biden presidency. Kathy was a writer, author, columnist, and blogging pioneer, as proud of her first book's Governor General's Award nomination as of her stint as Ed Enger for the Weekly World News. A target for cancel culture before the term was coined, she was denounced by all the best people, sometimes for contradictory reasons. Kathy did not lead a particularly full life, her existence having been comprised mostly of a series of unpleasant surprises. Her favorite corporeal pleasure was saying, "I told you so," which she was able to utter with justification multiple times a day. A bookish movie buff and agoraphobic homebody, as a child, Kathy, as per the Roz Chast cartoon, always preferred the little couch ride on the merry-go-round. Yet, Kathy managed to acquire a reputation for mouthiness, a side effect of her bull bleep allergy. I'm editing as I go. Contrary to cliche, Kathy did not conduct herself with particular grace, dignity, or courage in her final months. She didn't bravely fight on after her cancer was pronounced terminal. All she did was barely cope, and then only with assistance from her generous employer and some energetic and selfless friends, whom she'd somehow managed to acquire over the years, much to her astonishment. Of course, the greatest of these was her stalwart beloved of over 20 years, Arnie, with whom she is now in the ultimate long-distance relationship. They can all finally catch up on their sleep. The end. That, in a nutshell, is Kathy.
Now I'm crying again.
She was just, she brooked no nonsense. She told you like it was. She was as authentic as anybody. And we miss you. May you rest in peace, Kathy. She's now up there giving St. Peter a hard time, I bet.
Probably.
But she does. I'm sure she would appreciate all of our prayers. I think Kathy would, first of all, say, hey, I'm not a saint. Pray for me. So definitely she is in our prayers. So moving on from there. I think that was an.
That's a hard act to follow.
That's a hard act to follow. It's hard to segue. But we're going to move on to our next segment where we talk about what we've been eating. And darn it, I got out my sous vide again. I was determined to use the sous vide cooker again. So in case you don't remember, don't know, a sous vide is a circulating heater. It basically, you stick it in a bucket of water or a container of water, and it heats and circulates the water. And the idea is, and sous vide is French for, I don't know, cooked underwater. And the idea is you put food in it, usually vacuum sealed in a bag or put in a bag with the air sucked out for conductivity, you know, heat conductivity reasons. And it will, due to chemistry, you know, the little physical laws, it will heat the water up to a particular temperature. And by doing so, will heat up whatever is in the water to that temperature and then keep it there. Fairly indefinitely. Well, it will keep it at that temperature indefinitely, but the texture could end up breaking down if you leave it for too long. So that's actually, there's a myth that you can leave food in the sous vide forever and ever, and it will never go bad. It will actually end up breaking down at some point. But
biochemical processes still apply.
Yes. One of the famous ways to do this is to make a perfectly cooked piece of fish. Right. You put the fish in, it cooks it to that right temperature. You take it out. It's perfectly cooked. One of the downside is you don't get any of that Maillard reaction. You don't get browning.
It doesn't sound like an attractive piece of fish, frankly.
Right. Well, that's the thing about sous vide is this. It's always two steps. There's very few things that's just the one step. Like if we were getting the frozen seafood chowder at the farmer's market, mm-hmm. that would totally work in something like a sous vide because it doesn't need to be browned. It just needs to be heated. So anything that just needs to be heated up, especially if it needs to be heated up gently or gradually, would be ideal.
Right.
I mean, they used to sell the vegetables in a bag. Remember that from when we were kids? You don't see that as much now. Oh,
still sell vegetables in a bag.
No, the vegetables in the bag that you just throw into the pot of boiling water to heat them up. Do you remember that? There used to be ads for it. Like Bird's Eye or somebody, or you know.
They still sell those. Like, you're just supposed to put them in the microwave.
Okay. Yes. This was the before microwaves were as prevalent as they are back in the ancient days.
I don't remember those days.
Okay. So yes. Yeah, I know you're much younger than I am. So, I've used it a few times for various things. I think I've done steak in it. One of the things with steak is you cook it, you bring it up to a temp, and the steak is ideally like, if you like medium rare, like 124, 125. So you bring it up to like 124. And then you take it out and then you throw it into a hot pan, you know, one side, then flip to the other side, get it browned and then take it out. And it will be better than if you cooked it, you know, the whole way. It won't be mm-hmm. as, you know, have that big gray ring in it. So I'd picked up some New York strip steaks that were on sale at the market and had thrown those uh-huh. in the freezer. But it's not grilling weather. And so I hadn't been able to grill them, but I figured let's try it. But we'd forgot to defrost them. So I read online that you could cook the frozen meat. So we threw it in a in the vacuum seal bags, threw it in there. You're supposed to run it for an hour and a half, like a 1.5 times as long as you normally would. So I did that. It came out pretty good, right?
So you
this is the steaks.
Right. But you didn't, I mean, you warmed them up, like sort of defrosted them in the sous vide.
I cooked them in the sous vide.
But then you pan fried them on the stove.
If they were completely defrosted when I was to start, you put them in the sous vide for an hour to bring it up to 124. And then you take it out and you cook it in the pan on both sides. But if you're starting from frozen, you do 1.5 times. So it was in the sous vide for 90 minutes.
Okay. The whole 1.5 times confused me because you didn't really say 1.5 times. So, what?
Sorry. Well, yes. Well, the way that it was described in the article was confusing and I was trying to simplify it. And so I confused it even more. So anyway, so that's if you're cooking from frozen, but we wanted, so that, and that worked out. It was pretty good. Not as good as on the grill, but nothing ever is as good as,
but I think
it's always best on the grill.
Right. It's better on the grill, clearly, but you know, a cast iron pan and some butter and some garlic do the meat a lot of favors.
Oh, yeah.
So it was not bad.
If I'd had some fresh thyme, like a bundle of fresh thyme to throw in there, that would have been really good too.
Yeah. You know what I would really like is, I've had before is like a steak with a pepper and cream sauce, like lots of pepper and cream and a little bit of wine. That would be good too, but I think the kids would probably object to the amount of pepper that I'm thinking of.
Well, it's like a steak au poivre, the French steak,
right,
too. Yeah. I wonder if you could, I mean, would it be just as good if the sauce were served on the side?
Oh, maybe.
Those darn kids ruining everything. Yeah, I know. I agree. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So the, I'm thinking about how to work it. But so the second thing we want to do, so I'd also picked up a roast that was in the freezer, and we figured we'd try, like, we kept wanting to make it, but we kept forgetting to take it out to defrost it. This is our big problem, is we don't have a lot of room for defrosting things, so it's a project to defrost stuff.
Yeah.
And so I'll get to that, the big defrost thing we did today, in a second. So I said, can I defrost meat in the sous vide? And so this roast, like, what's it, 4 pounds, maybe?
Yeah, it was a decent size roast.
I put it in the vacuum seal bag, dropped it in. I set the sous vide for its lowest temperature, which is 100. I forget how I determined how long to do it. I think I looked it up, and I think I did it for like an hour, maybe, no, longer than an hour.
I have no idea. I wasn't paying attention.
It worked out. It actually worked out really well. It might have been even longer than an hour. I'll have to look up what I did again. But so then it was defrosted, not cooked. Took it out, put it in the oven.
Yeah, of course, we forgot to start the oven on at the right time. But that's
right, we
didn't
have to have that sit and all. But put in the oven using the Joy Cooking recipe for the roast beef, which works well. It's not fancy, but it works really well. And you bring it up to temp. I put the meat thermometer in it. You know, the new one that doesn't really work, but worked in this case. And brought it, I forget what the temp was, I brought it up to like 130 or something like that. And it was really good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out really well. So if you know, the sous vide, we have the Anova. I've heard a lot of good things about the Joule sous vide as well. And in fact, Cooks Illustrated rates the Joule higher and that sort of thing. The Anova has an app, like a phone app, that's supposed to be able to like control it and automate it from it. And it kind of works. It kind of doesn't. It tells me what temperature it's at and how long it's been going, but I can't really, for what some reason, it doesn't control properly. So I'm a little iffy on that. So the Joule might be a better choice, sous vide. But in any case, we got this one. I think we got it for free. I think it was a Vine. It was a Vine review. Bless you.
Oh.
So the other thing we defrosted was more than a month ago. Like, this was actually before your operation. So
2 months ago.
2 months ago, you saw on sale, what was it? A
It was a pork loin.
A big pork loin.
Like what was it, 9 pounds?
Yeah, it was over 9 pounds.
Right. It's a gigantic pork loin. And it was like...
$20.
$20 for 9 pounds of meat. I could not resist. And I intended to bring it home, chop it into two or three smaller pieces, like three smaller pieces, like three-pound chunks.
Yep.
And maybe make some of those into pork chops and maybe make one of them into like a roast or pulled pork or something. But... what happened was we didn't have enough room in the refrigerator and you were really busy and I was really tired. And so we threw it in the freezer saying, we'll come back to it tonight. It won't be all the way frozen through and we can chop it up then.
Can you guess what happened, folks? Did we come back to it that
we
night?
We did not come back to it. We were tired.
That's right.
And distracted.
And so now this gigantic hunk of frozen meat has been sitting in the middle of our chest freezer, taking up all kinds of space and worse, because it's this awkward, long, semi-curved shape now, because you had to kind of twist it in order to make it fit.
Right, right. It didn't freeze into a nice, like, straight plank. It kind of froze into this weird, like, S-shaped curve.
Like, to take up the maximum amount of space that 9 pounds of meat could take.
Right. In the freezer. It was the most awkward shape conceivable.
Which has been a pain in the butt since then, because now whenever we want to buy stuff and put it in the freezer, you got to, like, work it around it. So we kept saying, we got to figure out a way to defrost this safely. We got to figure out a way to, like, there was no, it can't fit in the fridge. So finally today, I'm like, okay, we just got to do this. If we lose it, it's $20 down the drain, but we've got to figure out how to do it. So I got the cooler. I filled it with tap water, put the big hunk of meat in it for a few hours. And it wasn't defrosted, but it was soft.
It was frozen, but still frozen, but soft enough that you could cut it.
Right. So I took a chunk of that. We made dinner. I cut the rest of it up to pork chops. Those are in the fridge, and I'm going to, because you can't refreeze them, so I'm going to try to cook them tomorrow.
That's the plan.
We'll see how it goes. But it was good, actually. The hunk of meat that I used tonight, we had sweet and sour pork stir fry.
It made really, really good sweet and sour pork. It was awesome.
Right. Cut the pork into about 1-inch chunks. And we dredged it in. So you dredge it in. You would dredge it in cornstarch, then egg white, and then I would use maybe whole egg. I should have used the whole egg.
Yeah.
I dredged it in egg white, but I should have used the whole egg. And then flour. So cornstarch, egg, flour, then about 1 inch of canola oil in a Dutch oven, and just, you know, let that cook until it's cooked through. I used the meat thrower to make sure it was done. It, you know, 165 was what I was looking at. And, put it in, you know, on a pan with
except we didn't use, we actually ended up using tapioca starch instead of cornstarch.
Right, but we had to use tapioca starch. I used a combination of tapioca starch and arrowroot instead of cornstarch, and I used white rice flour instead of wheat flour.
And that actually really, like, if you had told me that this was just regular, like, cornstarch and wheat, I would have believed you.
Yeah.
It did not taste any different from any other.
And the texture was good. It was a nice crunch.
Yeah, really good crunch.
Yeah.
Really good flavor.
And you made a sauce for the stir fry.
Yeah, the sauce was, I mean, it was a basic sweet and sour sauce. Ketchup, rice vinegar, brown sugar.
Soy sauce?
Soy sauce, Worcestershire sauce, and pineapple juice.
I wonder if you could have used either fish sauce or the Chinese black vinegar instead of Worcestershire.
Probably.
Yeah.
I thought it tasted really good.
It did.
And we had lots of, a lot of times when you get sweet and sour at like the Chinese restaurant, it comes with like minimal vegetables. It's like got bell peppers, onions, and
bell pepper, onion, and maybe snow peas or something.
Right. Maybe in pineapple chunks.
Right.
But we threw in some bok choy and mushrooms.
Yeah. Baby
and
bok choy, broccoli, mushrooms. Bell pepper, carrots, and onion and garlic, and mix it all together. It came out really good.
We had one child who wanted to eat only the meat. We had one child who really didn't like the meat, but ate lots of vegetables. One child who ate mostly rice and a couple pieces of meat and some onions and carrots. But I think everybody ate at least some of the stir fry, and nobody turned up their nose.
Nobody said they didn't like the taste of it. What they were rejecting was either the meat or the vegetables. but they like the sauce.
I was happy because I think the last time I made sweet and sour something or other, there were some objections to the sauce. Like they thought that it was kind of weird. And so I felt like this was a triumph. Everybody liked the sweet and sour sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It was good. Yeah, it worked out. All right, so that's what we've been eating. So what have we been reading and watching? Let's start with what we watched.
Yeah, because we watched a couple things together.
Yes. So last week after, the Monday, last Monday, we watched, but it premiered last Sunday, but we watched the season premiere of The Rookie, which is the Nathan Fillion cop show.
Let's face it, we're watching it because it's Nathan Fillion.
Yes, well, you know, Firefly. Mel! And because we have both like Castle, so that was right. Good, too. So if in case you don't know, it's a show about a guy who in midlife, he's a carpenter by trade. In midlife, he goes through a divorce and he lives in Pennsylvania. He packs up, moves to California, and becomes the oldest rookie ever in the LAPD.
LAPD, yeah.
Which is based on a true story. This guy who was in who was 40, I think, or 42 or something like that when he became a cop.
It's kind of fun because he's sort of the classic fish out of water.
But he's classic Midwestern values, too. He tries to see the best in people. He tries not to be cynical. He tries to
he's
honest and forthright.
He's such an optimistic. He's like the sort of classic, you know, Hollywood Boy Scout type.
He's like Ted Lasso, actually, which you haven't watched.
Haven't seen. So I can't
you need to. But it's it's actually, now I think about it, it's a lot like Ted Lasso. That is the uncynical, who sees the best in people and gets other people to start to see the best in others as well. And one of the things we've noticed in the shows that are the cop shows as they premiere or come out after the summer of 2020 with all of the unrest and the reckoning over police and relations with Black community and all that stuff that happened. How the different cop shows are dealing with that and how they're.
Because a cop show in 2021 can't just pretend like
nothing happened.
Nothing has happened and everything's the same. Like that would be totally, even if it was sort of believable because it was like supposed to be historical, it wouldn't feel authentic to where America is right now.
So like I watched the show SWAT, which features a Black protagonist. He's the main character is Black himself, a Black cop. And they've dealt with it okay. Some of it has felt a little heavy-handed at times. So very kind of a little like all right, we get the point. Like it really not like we don't need to talk about this sort of stuff, but it just felt very like
forced.
Okay, like driving the point very forced, very like over and over and over again driving this point in your face. But you and I both agreed that the way The Rookie handled it, I think, was the best possible way.
Well, I feel like the Rookie is really well written, and while it didn't feel like it needed to, it dealt with it in terms of like how would these people, if they're real, encounter, you know, the real world. So it wasn't like it wasn't message driven. It was character driven, which I think is the most authentic way to deal with messages, really, is because messages come from people's experiences. Like the lessons that we need to learn, we learn as people having experiences with the real world. And so I felt like what they did is they said, where are these characters? Where is this particular person right now in 2021, and how are they dealing with being a police officer?
Right.
And I really liked that approach.
There's a scene in which the head of internal affairs is dressing down a cop, and he's Black, and actually all the cops in the room were Black, and he is dressing this cop down, like saying internal affairs is not the enemy. And this is a really good point, because cop shows have constantly made the internal affairs guys out to be the narcs. They're the bad guys. They're always out to get us good cops, you know, to trick us. And he's like, we're not the enemy. We are the only part of the department that is mandated by the state constitution. We are here because police hold the power of life and death. They hold the power of the state's use of force in their hands, and therefore they need extra scrutiny, extra oversight. And And he was talking about, they kind of brought up some of the stuff having to do with what happened, you know, with the, you know, the police misuse of force and the cases. I don't think he brought up any by name,
no.
But brought up just the fact of it, the historical injustices that have occurred at the hands of cops, and did so in a even-handed, fair way, didn't paint all cops as bad guys, but said that there is a real problem and that we're trying to do, and you're, and this other cop had done something to undermine that, you're, you know, and I just love the righteous anger in him, you know, you're undermining us every time we're trying to do the, you're the reason why people have a problem with cops. Not he didn't say exactly that, but it was along those lines. And I just thought that was the best handling of this topic that I've seen so far in a police show on TV. So that was really good. And then, of course, it's Nathan Fillion, and you have the usual just fun, you know, him being him.
Yeah, they're wrapping up the season cliffhanger from last season.
I have to say, with that, I don't feel like they had to do it in an episode. Like, you could have, it felt a little neatly wrapped up. Like, they created this whole drama, and then, I mean, he was in literal jeopardy for losing his job, going to prison, and then by the end of the 48 minutes, wherever it is, you know, things are wrapped up nicely, and he's back on the job. He has a reprimand in his file, like, well, yeah, you know, whatever. You know. Wow.
Right. I mean, the show, if the show has one weakness, it's the tendency to kind of...
It's episodic.
Be episodic. Right. It's episodic.
Right. There isn't... I mean, the characters do grow over time.
They do.
But it's designed to be neatly packaged. It's not a serialized show like a lot of shows are today. So they weren't going to carry this on for several episodes.
But it was okay.
Yeah, yeah. But it's still one of our favorite shows that we watch it together. The other thing we watched together was, I don't know whether it's technically called Wonder Woman 84 or just WW84.
I have no idea.
Let's call it Wonder Woman 84. So
that's clearer. Anyway.
We watched it together because I was doing a podcast, which has been recorded but not yet released, but Secrets of Movies and TV Shows. You'll have to go check that out at sqpn.com/movies. Nope, sqpn.com/secrets. Don't give me the wrong URL. And I'm on a panel with Maria Johnson, Angela Ciolana, Father Chip Hines, and Andrew Hermes. We all talk about the Wonder Woman 84. But you and I watched it together so I could prepare for it. And so what do you think of it?
I did not like it as well as I liked the first Wonder Woman. I really like Gal Gadot. And
me too.
she's great. I felt like this. Well, they kind of lost me early on in the show, in the
movie,
in the story, because
without getting too much spoilers,
they did something that didn't they didn't lay the groundwork for or explain the mechanism by which it happened. And after that, they kind of lost my suspension of disbelief for the rest of the movie.
It was literally Deus Ex Machina.
Right.
There were several moments where it was literally Deus Ex Machina. Like, there was literally, at one point, the airplane, God in the machine. Like, that's the only way to explain that. But like, there was a moment where the personhood of someone was sort of pushed aside, and we're supposed to sort of just ignore this for the sake of the main characters.
Right.
It didn't feel right, and it didn't feel true to the characters.
It could have been done in so many different ways. It could have been explained in so many ways.
Way. Yeah.
And it lost me.
Right.
And then there were quite a few places where I felt like it lost me.
It was confusing.
It was confusing.
Things that only got explained after the fact.
It was confusing, and I just kept being thrown out of it and like thrown out of the story and thinking about like the writing and thinking about the plotting and thinking about the characterization, and like my analytic brain didn't shut up and enjoy the ride.
There was no scene like that battlefield scene in the first one, like that awesome scene of Wonder Woman crossing the no man's land in World War One.
Yeah,
there wasn't that. But OK, that said, Gal Gadot was awesome in it.
She's great. I love her.
I can't wait to see her in that Cleopatra movie. That should be pretty awesome. They're talking about casting her in a Cleopatra movie.
Right. Yeah. I seem to remember seeing that.
Pedro Pascal was awesome. He was over the top, but there was tender moments, smaller moments, I should say, especially yeah. near the end, that really he sold.
Yeah.
So I don't want to get into too many spoilers here. So if you want that, or if you've watched it already, definitely go listen to the Secrets of Movies and TV Shows. It should be out on Thursday, the 14th, right. If I get it edited in time, which I will.
Right. I mean, I didn't hate it. I didn't love it either. And I was just my major feeling was kind of disappointed that
they could have been so much more.
That it wasn't better.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, stick around through the credits, at least halfway through the credits. You know what I mean? There's a mid-credit scene. One of the things that made Wonder Woman so good in the DC universe, which is where she is all of the other ones are so dour. Whereas Wonder Woman in the original was she was fresh. She wasn't naive, but she was innocent. You know, there right. was this fresh. And whereas in this one, she's sad. And she's
yeah,
a little weary, you know.
I felt like and in some ways they didn't earn the sadness with this story. I don't know.
Well, I mean, she knew Trevor, Steve Trevor, for what, a week, maybe a month in the first one.
And the jump.
And now it's 70 years later and right. she's still pining for him.
I think it's the jump in time too. 70 years is a long time. And I didn't feel like. What has she been doing for 70 years that she's still stuck in this moment?
Right. Still emotionally stuck in that moment.
Right. I feel like she's a character at the beginning who's stuck. And I don't feel like they get her out of it in a way that felt really true to the character.
Well, it's like Doctor Who, the most recent one, Doctor Who, where the New Year special. She'd been in prison for decades at the beginning of that. And yet she's still in angst over the stuff that she learned about her history in the previous episode, which was decades earlier.
I think that writing a character who is supposed to have had a really long time break is hard because we can't really, it's hard to comprehend 70 years, decades yeah. of your life. And yet you look the same, like you haven't aged, but.
Yes. Writing immortal characters. Because they don't, if they were immortal, they don't change very much over time, or do they? Or maybe they could, I suppose, but they have to experience so much in life.
Right. How do you keep them human and yet have them live these like inhuman spans of time?
Right. They have to remain relatable, and it's hard. It's a Doctor Who and Wonder Woman have the same issues.
The same problem.
Maybe Gal Gadot could be the next Doctor.
No, I could get behind that.
I could get behind that. all right, we're running along, so let's talk about the book you're reading that you mentioned.
Right. I joined an online reading club because I really love online reading groups. They help me keep me accountable. And we are reading, excuse me, we're reading Robert Hugh Benson's Friendship of Christ, which I always want to say Friendship with Christ, but it's Friendship of Christ. And our friends, Kat and Brendan Hodge, have started a new small press. And they realized that Friendship of Christ was only available in really bad editions. It's been out of print for a long time. And it's only available in really bad editions. And so they've reset it and reprinted it. And it's a beautiful edition.
It's out of copyright, so they're
right.
They have so it's anyone could do this.
But they've done a really nice job, and it's available both in Kindle and in print. I got the Kindle edition because I didn't want to wait, and we have a little bit of a shelf problem right now.
Yes, room for books. Yes.
So I went with the Kindle edition, and you can thank me for that.
Thank you. You're welcome.
So. It's an old book, and I kind of expected it's an old book and it's an old religious book. And even though I've really enjoyed quite a few of Father Benson's novels, I really, really love
Lord of the World.
No, Lord of the World was good, but I really love his historical novels that take place during the English Reformation period. I'm trying to remember by what authority the kings.
The Necromancers?
No.
Okay.
It was by what authority? Come Rack, Come Rope.
Oh, Come Rack, Come Rope.
Yeah. And there's one other one, The King's Business, The King's something or
there's
other.
There's quite a number of them. He has a lot of books.
Yeah. He was very prolific. He was a Anglican priest who converted and became a Catholic priest. The King's Achievement, right? That one's about Henry VIII and the closing of the monasteries. I really liked his historical novels, so it's not really a surprise that I would enjoy a nonfiction book by him. But it feels really fresh, and it's very easy to read. We're reading two chapters a week and talking about them. And so far, I've found that I could read a chapter in one sitting, which is really nice when you're a busy mom with lots and lots of things to read and do. Thinking about friendship and thinking about friendship with Christ, it's kind of easy to spout platitudes, and it's harder to dig into what does that actually mean. It's been a really good read. And so if you're looking for some spiritual reading to start off your new year, I highly recommend it.
Yeah. And then if you buy it through the link that we'll put on the show notes on our website, you will be able to support a Catholic family that is starting a new effort to get great classics of Catholic literature out there in nice looking editions. That's actually a big part of this, I think.
Right. Wanting it to look pretty.
There's a lot of shovelware out there for these old books, right, that are with terrible cover art. Right.
They just take a scan of the book and they don't bother to clean it up and make it look
nice.
Fix
the typos.
One things that I know Kat did was she changed all the scripture references and updated them because Father Benson is using like Roman numerals, which is really hard for modern readers to read.
Yes.
So LXIV. What is L in Roman numerals again? Yeah, right. I don't remember.
Yeah.
So she updated it.
64.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. So very good. So let's finish out by talking about today is, as we record, is the Feast of the Baptism of the Lord. It's the liturgical close of the Christmas season.
Sadly.
After this, we are in the green of ordinary time.
We celebrated by taking down our Christmas tree.
We did. We took down our tree and our decorations, and I hauled it out into the side yard where it will sit until it turns brown, and we cut it up and burn it this summer.
It will make a lovely bonfire.
It will make a lovely fire. But so the end of the season. And so you read something. Someone had shared something online, a quote from St. Gregory Nazianzen.
Yes.
One of the early church fathers. And so you were going to read this excerpt from it, which was really kind of cool. These early church fathers really have a way.
I really like the way they sort of teach through story. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of more modern writers want to just like
to give you the theological download.
Right. Download it. Mm-hmm. So St. Gregory is talking about baptism and the importance of baptism. And he's talking about the temptations. He says baptism doesn't protect us from temptation.
Right.
Didn't protect Jesus. Jesus was
tempted in the desert.
And so he sort of tells like what our own experiences of experiencing the same kinds of temptation that Jesus does. But I really liked this one. If the tempter tries to overthrow us through our greed, showing us at one glance all the kingdoms of the world as if they belong to him, and demanding that we fall down and worship him, we should despise him. We know him to be a penniless impostor. Strong in our baptism, each of us can say, I too am made in the image of God, but unlike you, I have not yet become an outcast from heaven through my pride. I have put on Christ. By my baptism, I have become one with him. It is you that should fall prostrate before me. By these words, he can only surrender and retire in shame as he retreated before Christ, the light of the world. So will he depart from those illumined by that light. Such are the gifts conferred by baptism on those who understand its power. Such the rich banquet it lays before those who hunger for the things of the spirit. I really like the characterization of the tempter as a penniless imposter, which is one of those things that, you know, like when he offers Jesus the kingdoms of the world, they're not his to give.
Doesn't it strike you as a little presumptuous? Like, it's like a guy showing up at your front door trying to sell you your car.
Right. I got this great car.
Look at this car, friend. Isn't it great? I'll sell it to you for just a small price. That's mine. It's right. Like when the government offers to give you, you know, a stimulus check. Oh, no, that's something else. That was mine to begin with. Anyway, no politics. But yeah, the devil as the father of lies, he offers nothing. He has nothing to offer us that isn't already ours. That's the key. You know, all of the temptations of sin are temptations to things that are ours by right in their proper context and means. You know, like there's doing it the way that the devil wants is the sin. You know, trying to think of an example that is family friendly. But for example, marital relations within its proper context and use is a beautiful gift of God that is ours as married people already by right. But what the devil offers is a pale facsimile, a twisted version of it. You know, that here, you can have the seeds. I made this for you. Like, I've twisted it and made it awful and ugly and evil. And here you go. And this is some gross thing that, you know, I'm giving you now. And it's like, no, like, it's not yours to give. It's already, you know, it's God's and it's his gift to us as his children. So I do love that part too. Yeah.
Right. But then again, the, it's you that should fall prostrate before me that is probably the most bold refutation of the devil I've ever seen. And I don't know that I would ever dare to go there, but St. Gregory is one of the church fathers and he goes there.
Well, it reminds me of the St. John Vianney, who was plagued by demons at night.
Right.
He would wake him from his sleep. And one night he woke up, lifted his covers, looked down at the end of his bed, and the devil stood there and he said, "Oh, it's you," and went back to sleep. Like, I'm not sure I would have that same reaction, but I'm also not a saint. Right.
But it really does show that, like, by virtue of our baptism, we really have nothing to fear. Well, as long as we cling to what's true, which is the image of Christ that's given to us, that's imposed on us, imparted to us at our baptism.
Oh, the worst he can do, and maybe not even this, I may be off theologically, but the worst he can do is take our life, you know, our earthly life. But he can't truly kill us, that we do that for ourselves, you know, spiritual death, you know, through sin. He can't, he really can't do the lasting damage that we're afraid of. We're only afraid of the things he can do to us in this life. It reminds me of, you know, the sin of Adam. What Adam was supposed to do when confronted by the snake, by the serpent, which when you read the Hebrew, it wasn't just a snake hanging off a branch, but it was more like a dragon, like his great evil snake beast, Shmaug. was to stand before his bride and defend her with his life and give his life for her if necessary, at which point the resurrection, you know, God would have resurrected him. You know, that was, but Adam's sin was to doubt that and to stand aside.
Right.
And to leave her unprotected. But Christ stood in front of his bride, the church, and gave his life in defending her against the serpent. And was resurrected, just like it was, like was promised. Like, see, this was what was supposed to happen. And so, like, the Satan has no real power over us. He has no power. Again, I'm not sure that I'm bold enough to tell him you should be bowing before me. But you know, there's a truth in that.
Yeah, it was a nice way of sort of thinking about baptism.
What is we become baptism? By baptism.
Right. What baptism is for us. There's lots of different things you could, places you could go and directions you could go for right. The baptism of the Lord. But I thought that was a good.
Yeah. In baptism, we share in the prophet, priest, and kingship of Jesus. Kingship Yeah, there you go. All right, let's wrap it up.
Okay.
We do want to take a moment as we wrap it up to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Robert G, Sean L, Susan R, Trevor W, and John E. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. And now's a great time to become a StarQuest patron, thanks to a generous gift from a StarQuest supporter. When you start a new Patreon monthly pledge at sqpn.com/give, the first 3 months will be matched by an equal donation, an equal amount from our donor. My app that I'm reading from went away for a second. So if you become a new patron at $10 a month after 3 months, our donor will give $30 to StarQuest to support all our shows, including this one, making your gift go even further. So if you've been thinking of becoming a StarQuest patron, now is the time. Visit sqpn.com/give today. So that's it from us. If you have any feedback for us on anything we've talked about, or if you want to find links to any of the things we discuss, including the book, The Friendship of Christ, you can find them at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. You can find us at the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. Remember to like Raising the Bets on our Facebook page, retweet us on Twitter where we're at SQPN, and be sure to leave us comments online, and we love to hear from you. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.